subtle little glimmer, some suggestion that you'd have me if I could only make me better, then I would stand a little stronger as I walk a little taller all the time. Because I know you are a cynic, but I think I can convince you, yeah, cause broken people can get better if they really want to, or at least that's what I have to tell myself if I am hoping to. And one day this will all be over. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Recovery Radio, your weekly radio show that talks about addiction and recovery issues live from the downtown east side of Vancouver. And I'm here in studio with my co-host, Mr. Darren Gerler. Hello, Darren.
Hey, I'm here.
You're here. Yeah, traffic.
Just sitting down.
Just walked in. I'm like, where's Darren? Yeah, parking is pretty difficult down here in the downtown east side, but I'm glad you made it, Darren. Thank you. I'm not sweating.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, so we've been on air for 4 years, and this is amazing. We've got our YouTube channel going. We're now on iTunes, and to all of you that watch us on Facebook Live, hello. Second half of the show is going to be great, where we do our personal stories, and Darren, we're like into the thousands of watchers and listeners and all that, so we're really excited.
Mm-hmm.
It's all you, Darren.
No, come on.
Come on, say it's all me.
It is all you.
Thank you. So today we are going to be talking recovery with the theme of Women Do Recover. And we're going to get into that in just a couple of minutes. For those of you that are here in Vancouver and reading the local media, Mary Claire, who's the in charge of social policy for the city of Vancouver, she did an announcement yesterday talking about the overdose crisis here in Vancouver and actually the whole Lower Mainland, and the numbers are like three times as high as previous years, and thousands of people have passed away in 2017. They do say that the numbers are slightly going down, but I think it's just too early to tell what's really going on. And, you know, a shout out to Ann Livingston, who's a friend of Talk Recovery. She was given mentions about being one of the heroes during the overdose crisis with the overdose prevention sites that have been popping up in Vancouver. So we are going to be talking more about the overdose crisis on some future shows. Specifically, I think it's time we bring back to the show Dr. Scott McDonald for a follow-up to see how the heroin clinics are doing. He was on the show about a year ago as they were all really just starting. So I think it's time we talk to him and see how the changes are there. So if you want to be a guest on Talk Recovery, message us on Facebook at Talk Recovery Vancouver, or you can contact us on our website, talkrecoveryradio.com. So, Darren, we're going to start the show off. Frances usually starts our show off every week, but she's not in the studio today, so shout out to Frances, our co-host. Today we're talking about gender-specific approaches to addiction treatment, and we have international expert Dr. Stephanie Covington on the show today. Hello, Dr. Covington.
Hello. Congratulations on your show for 4 years.
Yeah, we're excited. It started off 4 years ago, just a small idea, and we're like, you know, just a couple of recovering addicts here, and we're like, oh, let's do this show. People aren't talking about recovery enough, and you know, next thing you know,
here we are
4 years later. Yeah, 4 years younger. yes. So I did some research on you. We are really happy to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Talk Recovery is powered by two treatment centers, one called Last Door Recovery Center. The other is called Westminster House. Westminster House is a program for women. Last Door is a program for men. So we're really excited to learn more about your thoughts on gender-specific treatment. Dr. Covington has wrote some amazing books and been part of some amazing literatures. Some highlights are Helping Women Recover, a program for treating addiction, Beyond Trauma, a healing journey for women. One's called Beyond Anger and Violence, a program for women. And another great book that we're going to talk more specifically about is A Woman's Way Through the 12 Steps. So we're going to start off just with a little bit of your background. So can you let us know who you are and tell us about your role at the Center for Gender and Justice and the Institute of Relational Development, what those are and what your role is?
Sure. I've been working in the addiction field since the early 80s, originally talking really focused on services for women, which because of that led me into understanding the connection between addiction and trauma. And my work more recently in the last few years has also focused particularly on women and girls in the criminal justice system. So the Institute for Relational Development in La Jolla is more of a clinical practice, which actually I don't have anymore, but any work that is not criminal justice focused we do through the Institute in terms of consulting and training for treatment providers and people who want to know more about addiction and trauma. And then the Center for Gender and Justice focuses on policies and practices in community or custodial settings for women and girls. Although, speaking of gender, you know, when the whole idea of gender and being gender specific or gender responsive really started, we were focusing on females. But today it's quite different. We realize that gender is not binary. It isn't just male and female. We certainly have a transgender population. We have people who are gender nonconforming. And we also realize that as we've been developing gender-focused services for females, that now we're developing gender-focused interventions for males. So, and that takes lots of different forms in terms of programming and groups as well as policies and practices. So it's lots of different things that I do and get involved in.
So the one thing that I found when I was doing some research is you've been, which I love, having on our show, an advocate. And when you started doing this, there weren't gender-specific treatments, and there was a lot of work that needed to be done. Can you tell us a little bit of where we were back then, just to get a construct of
sure
what happened?
Well, if we go back into the 80s, almost all the programs were co-ed, and in the process of being co-ed, they were essentially designed for men. Women were expected to fit into that. A lot of the groups were co-ed, very often many more men than women, so that women didn't speak up as much, and often their issues were not addressed specifically. Today, we realize that actually women and men do very different kinds of work in a co-ed group versus a male-specific or female-specific group in terms of the language they use, the level of engagement, what they share. It's just a whole different process. So today we're much more focused on also considering gender or socialization, the messages males and females get growing up and how that impacts their lives and how that impacts the lives of someone who's transgender who grew up with certain messages that they feel didn't fit them at all. So we look a lot at that.
So I don't know the
number.
Sure, go ahead. No, I don't know the numbers, but there's lots of treatment centers in North America, and I'm assuming many are co-ed in the private sector, it seems mm-hmm. like. So would you suggest, you know, for people that are listening and have a loved one that may be using and so forth, it's always client-specific and client-centered. So what do you think as a clinician and been doing this for a long time, would you make a recommendation like a gender-specific treatment center is better than? Or what's your take on that? For I'm choosing to go to treatment somewhere. What do you think?
Yeah, for someone who's thinking about going to treatment or has a loved one, and let's say the person is female, I think I would want to ask that program provider what they do that's specific for women. Do they have any women's only groups? Or I would look for a program that specifically treats females. We have research now that shows it's more effective, that women do better when they're separated. We certainly know that most adolescent treatment is co-ed, which is really a nightmare because both males and females are defocusing from themselves and focusing on other, which isn't really the point of primary treatment. So Yeah, I would look for a program that treats women, has experience with women, and or if it's a co-ed program, I would find out what they do that's specific for women. I also want to use a male example for you.
Okay.
Because those of us who've done this work for years with women and girls have said if we can get it right for women and girls, it'll improve services for men and boys. And if you only focus on service for men and boys, it never improves services for women and girls. So it doesn't go both ways. So one of the things we learned when we wrote Helping Men Recover, which is the male version of Helping Women Recover, one of the things we do in the beginning is we ask men, what are the messages you got growing up about what it means to be a man? So we all know what those are, right? Be strong, don't cry, don't show your feelings, do it yourself, be tough, all that stuff. And then we ask the men, what are you learning you're going to need to do to sustain your recovery? Be vulnerable, show your feelings, ask for help. All these things are antithetical to what men learned growing up. So that's about being gender responsive for men. It's taking into consideration the reality of men's lives, just like we take into consideration the realities of the lives of women and girls in the materials that we design for them.
That's amazing. I think, for the fact that we had to fight to get gender-specific treatment is just an indication on how people view addiction, whether it's a healthcare issue or whether it's a justice issue or a moral issue and so forth. We have hospitals where you go into a hospital. It's kind of one of those things where addiction treatment, you're not really in there to deal with your addiction. You're in there to deal with whatever the health crisis is that you have, but addiction caused maybe the liver or whatever else situation you have. So that's going on for you in that moment. But the hospital is really not going to help you with the alcoholism that you have.
No.
For to get
no,
in there.
They'll treat your liver problem, but they won't talk to you about
exactly.
That alcohol created it. No, it's amazing even today when you think of where we are with medical knowledge, with what we know about brain science, all of these things, how much struggle there still is in most communities to get help for people, get services.
And that's why I brought this up. I wanted to ask for your opinion on, are we where we can be for, not just gender-specific treatment, but for treatment, or do we still have a long way to go and we're not even nearly near where we're supposed to be for treating people with alcoholism or drug addiction?
Yeah, the numbers I've seen is about 10% of the people that need treatment get it. So I'd say we have a long way to go. People have a hard time thinking about this as a chronic illness. They still treat it as it's an acute episode, not like what we do with other chronic illnesses. And, in the last few years, it's become something I've been talking about for a long time, but it's become quite acceptable, and people realize that very often a person's trauma history is also related to their addictive disorder. And yet we have a lot of treatment providers that don't do anything around trauma. So I think we have a long way to go still. Okay.
So the show's theme, Women Do Recover. So I want to talk to you about the book, A Woman's Way Through the 12 Steps. So my question is, a lot of people want to talk about AA and, let's focus on our similarities, not our differences. And there's those conversations like you shouldn't have specialized meetings and you shouldn't have, men's meeting or women's meeting or meetings for LGBTQ communities and we should all be in a room together. But the reality is we don't all want to be in a room together sometimes. So
I think there's value to being in rooms together, and there's a value to being in a room with people that are different than we are. I mean, I don't think that I wouldn't argue that. However, there's also value to being in places where you feel a different level of support because of commonalities. Mm-hmm. And, the reason I wrote A Woman's Way Through the 12 Steps, and I went around and I interviewed women who'd recovered in a variety of 12-step programs, AA, NA, Overeaters Anonymous, gamblers, a variety of 12-step programs, because I wanted there to be women's voices, because all of the basic 12-step literature is all male voices. And women have always been told, well, you can just translate, and that's true. But sometimes it's more powerful to hear a woman talk about what powerlessness meant to her or what doing an inventory meant to her. And you find women use different language. They talk, you know, one woman talked about doing an inventory. She said, well, I see it. It's like doing a spring cleaning in my closet. I go in and I throw out the things that I don't like anymore. I look at things that need mending, and then I keep the things I like. She said, doing a 12-step is just doing that about yourself. Well, no one talks about that in the big book or in the basic 12 and 12.
No,
but women can relate to spring cleaning.
Exactly. Yeah.
Closet cleaning. So it's different language, because my goal in this is I believe in the 12 steps. I think they're things we could critique and say are problematic. However, they're free in our communities. They're readily available in many places. And I wanted women to find a way to attach to 12 steps, to be engaged with them, because for many women, it's the only support system they're going to have. And I know for some women, they had difficulty feeling, particularly in co-ed meetings, that this would work for them.
So
the book has helped women go to 12-step meetings because they hear women's voices in the book.
So it's a support tool for women that are embarking on their recovery journey or in their recovery journey and just need a little bit of guidance and support from some other voices of some like-minded people. So you're a physician, you're a scientist, you're a researcher. What do you say to people that don't think there's evidence for AA and a woman's guide to recovery should be medication and not the 12 steps and so forth? What's the conversation? What's your narrative about all that?
Well, number one, I don't believe that people heal in isolation. I believe they heal in connection, male or female or trans or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to help people get connected to other people, and I think that's what 12-step groups do. They also provide support. I don't think, for some people, they can be the sole intervention or the sole form of the catalyst to help someone into recover. For other people, they need extra things, and this is more of a support system and an adjunct. So for some people, it's primary. For some, it's they needed, you know, treatment first and then continue in AA. And there's many people who also recover without AA. I don't think there's one way. But I think throwing AA out as something that people say, well, can't work or it's not scientific or whatever the argument is really missing a program. I mean, there are 126 in the United States, 126 different self-help groups based on the concepts of the 12 steps. And in my mind, the 12 steps are nothing but principles for living life. And they can be useful to a lot of people struggling with a lot of different things.
Oh, I know. There's a lot of people that don't do drugs that I only wish would do a set of steps.
Exactly.
You know? Can you please just do these steps?
Oh, well, sometimes when I look at, even before our current political situation, our previous another time, I thought, you know, they talk about it as, you know, principles. I talk about principles for living life, and I think, man, if we had more politicians living from these principles, we'd be in a lot better shape.
Now, when you say principles for living life, for someone that's listening that might not know what that even means, can you give us a hint on what that means?
Sure. I think the concept that there's something in the world greater than you are. You may want to call it God, but you may not. I had a client one time who couldn't do anything around that, but she realized the ocean. She was a swimmer, that the ocean was more powerful than she was. But believing that there's a force in the universe greater than you are, believing and understanding that control is an illusion and learning how to let go of those things you can't control versus making yourself crazy trying to control things that you can't. So some level of acceptance. I think there's just a lot of principles embedded in the steps, the whole idea of making amends, that when you screw up and do something that isn't quite on target, that you go back and you apologize to people, and then you make a living amends, which is you change your behavior and don't do that again. So I think all of those are principles for living.
Which step makes me quit heroin?
Which step makes you quit heroin?
I think I say that jokingly, because I think a lot of the misunderstanding is you know, not along the narrative that you just mentioned. It's, you know, people are presented the 12 steps or into a 12-step program or through treatment possibly, and it's almost like it's brought about that this is what's going to keep you clean. and it's not that it doesn't, but it doesn't. It's not like the quick fix to not smoking, or the quick fix to stop eating, or the quick fix to quitting drugs. It's just once you've quit drugs and you're that person clean that wants to use drugs, here are now some tools that you have to implement in your life.
And these are the tools for living life.
Right.
That's what I said. I think a lot of people need a treatment. I don't consider 12 steps treatment.
Right.
I believe for some people, they are the primary intervention that helps them change. But a lot of people need more than that. And when we look at this opioid epidemic, I believe 12 steps can have a role in, like you say, helping people once they've stopped using.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly.
But there are other things that have to be in place first. I mean, there's a theory, and I don't even know if it's true, but it's an interesting idea, that if you have a habit, and I'll risk saying addiction's a habit. I don't think it's a habit, but I think it's in the brain in a similar way, like it's a repetitive behavior that becomes part of our brain chemistry. But the theory is that if you can change a habit for 21 days, then in fact you can make life changes.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a period of time to really undo behavior that we're constantly doing.
And so
you
started, you know, advocating for gender specific treatment centers and gender specific programs, and you and your colleagues fought, you know, the predominantly male industry of addiction treatment, and you've won. And so now we're in a place, I'm in a place of being an advocate for long-term treatment, because a lot of people that are in the front lines and making policies and making decisions, insurance companies being one of them, it's all outpatient, intensive outpatient. It's all 28 days, 14 days. And when you even think of like 90 days treatment, it's like, who in their right mind needs to do 90-day treatment? And meanwhile, people are dying. So we're in a place.
A lot of people need 90-day treatment.
Exactly. You know, to change a habit. And I mean, you can't just change a habit from sitting somewhere for an hour, a week, or a day, or whatever.
No.
So I'm trying to think, like, you know, what you've had success in changing the way treatment happens in the United States and Canada. So I want to hear from, maybe you got any insight for us who are, you know, on the front lines of trying to change the mentality that addiction treatment really isn't necessary as a way to help curb. Because in Portugal, they have state-funded two-year treatment programs, which is the norm for people in Portugal. And that's what they started about 15 years ago, is getting people into these two-year programs. In North America, it's you know, a novelty to go to a treatment center for that long. So what can we do? What were some of the strategies you did? Just keep talking?
Yeah, I think one, you don't give up. I think that you find people around you that support your point of view, so you don't always feel the lone person in the crowd of naysayers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we try to educate people as best we can. So, for example, I mean, Portugal's done lots of things about legalizing drugs, providing, like you said, providing long-term treatment. They have the lowest drug rate in the
world.
Yeah,
they have one of the lowest. They have one of the lowest overdose mortality rates.
Exactly, and this has been sponsored by the government. Mm-hmm. We know in this country, at least our country, and I'm going to say Canada similarly, that that for people to get long-term treatment, they have to have a lot of resources.
Yeah.
Publicly funded programs are not long-term. But Portugal did that differently. They made it part of their federal drug policy. And what happens in our country, well, what's happened in the U.S. right now is the person in charge of our drug policy is now a 24-year-old that has absolutely no experience with anything in the drug field at all. He's 24, and he was part of our president's campaign.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, it's the most appalling. He's in charge of drug policy. So
that's insulting.
Let's just think where that's going to go.
Yeah.
So much of it's driven by the dollar. And it's become politicized. So I think you have to just keep on keeping on. You find your allies wherever you can find them.
Did you ever feel like...
You create a solid voice.
I was in a situation where I was talking to a policymaker the other day, and I just felt like I was the crazy man on the sidelines, you know, with the, you know, believe in Jesus sign kind of thing. Like,
right.
Am I insane? Like, am I the bad guy? Am I crazy? And we were talking about the two-tiered healthcare system where if you're rich, you go to an abstinence-based treatment center, continuing care. If you're a doctor, you get, like, a five-year treatment plan. But if you're below the poverty line or just uneducated or just don't really have any money, it's like, here's outpatient, here's harm reduction, here's medication, and enjoy your life. And it's like, I can see it so clearly, but, you know, people that can actually make a change are on this, you know, what can we, there's just no urgency or no response. So, and I just felt like, you know, defeated, kind of, where
well,
I was
you want to find other people in Canada that believe in the value of long-term care so that there's a larger voice across your country. I mean, that's what we did with Women's Services. In the 80s, there probably were a dozen of us that were working and living all across the U.S., and we would see each other periodically at conferences, and it helped support each other, and we just never gave up talking about it.
Oh, I so admire that. That's what we're going to do, Darren. We're never going to give up talking about it.
No, you don't. And you point out, and I keep thinking maybe, but maybe this is Pollyannish, that maybe this opioid epidemic will be the thing that gets people's attention. Because I know in this country, there have been difficulties, of course, for years, but now that it's in neighborhoods that are more white and more middle class, it's getting more attention.
Yes.
If it was only in poor neighborhoods and people of color in this country, we didn't talk about it.
We've got a couple of minutes left. I'm going to ask you a question, and I really want to hear your response to it before we go to our first break.
Sure.
I go to lots of conferences throughout the year, and I've been to many stakeholder meetings over the last, you know, decade or so. And, you know, there have been so many situations of hearing expert speakers on stage or at a room of stakeholders say abstinence doesn't work, abstinence kills people, there's no evidence for 12 steps. Like, just really, you know, just saying that I've seen tons of literature saying opiate addicts cannot get clean, 100% of them relapse, they must be on opiate replacement medication long term. And that's okay, but the minute somebody says, hey, maybe we need to take a look at harm reduction as not the number one response to addiction and so forth, you all of a sudden become this, you know, monster, this bad person, and how can you say that? I have not been around as long as you. I'm not as educated as you are. You've got a great bio. How would you respond to something like that? I'm trying to look for information for myself, actually.
Sure.
Too.
Well, number one, you have a bigger problem. Harm reduction has been a model, sort of a primary model in Canada more than in the U.S. Mm-hmm. because we sort of started treatment as an abstinence base. But when people start to tell me, here's what I say. I say there are many people who are abstinent. There are many people who have been on opioids who are abstinent. I do agree that medication-assisted treatment is a very good idea, but we have to keep abstinence on the continuum of what's possible in people's lives. And, you know, different people recover in different ways, and we want to provide all of those options to people. There are many people who've been on methadone for years and they're functioning fine, and there are other people who've been on methadone and they got off of it.
Yep.
Or other medications because they didn't want to be on it, and they've done it. So when people say it doesn't work, it just isn't true.
I wish we could all say everything works. It's the patient's right to choose their destiny, but guided by a physician with a non-biased opinion.
Right. You want to have a lot of tools in the toolbox, and you want to offer people a lot of hope.
And
a lot of information about, yes, recovery works.
Thank you so much for being on our show. This has been great. Women do recover. We're talking to
Absolutely.
Dr. Stephanie Covington, and your website is... I just had it up here. Where did it go?
StephanieCovington.com.
All information about her books are there. Some amazing literature that you can use to help yourself, help your loved one, to guide them to learn more about recovery from trauma and addiction. Thank you for being on our show today. We hope you enjoyed it.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Yes,
and good
thank
luck to you.
You
both.
Have a great day. Thanks for being on our show. That was Dr.
Sure.
Stephanie Covington on Talk Recovery Radio. And we're going to go to our first song break as we continue our theme with Women Do Recover. Darren, who are we listening to and talking to next?
Well, we're going to be talking with Jordan and Christy on our personal story segment. In the words of Dr. Covington, keep on keeping on, never give up. Not a bad little message to leave there. Let's go to Hannah Gorgeous. Georgis, I don't know how to pronounce your last name, but this is The Deep End.
Are you calling from a
And that was Hannah Jorgis, The Deep End. We're on Talk Recovery, Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. Welcome, listeners, and welcome to all of you Facebook Livers. I love this because you can go home and you can watch this show at any point of the day. You don't have to be listening right now, but we appreciate the listeners. And if you want to keep this station going and our show going, donate. Get to the website at the Vancouver Co-op Radio and donate. Become a member. So now it's time for our personal stories. This is I don't know. It's kind of my favorite part of the show. I think it's awesome having people come in, share a little bit about their story, no different today. But to keep with the theme of women in recovery or women do recover, we have Jordan with us. Welcome, Jordan.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming. And we have Christy also. I mean, since you're being filmed, we might as well introduce you as well. Coming in, and we'll talk to her a little bit at the end of the show. But let's talk with Jordan first. Jordan, tell us a little bit about, your story, your addiction. What was it like for you?
So my addiction didn't really start until, it didn't get out of hand until I was in college. I got in a bad car accident, and so I started using prescription pills, and that eventually turned into heroin, which turned into fentanyl. And I've used other drugs, but my main addiction was heroin and fentanyl. And I guess my addiction had taken me to, from being in college and having, a good life, good family, material stuff, non-material stuff, happiness, to homelessness on the streets. I also got pregnant in my addiction, and I thought that was going to be something that was going to be able to get me clean, but I was not able to stay clean through my pregnancy.
Well, typical story, right? Somebody gets hurt, bad car accident, requires, needs a heavy pain med. Was there any, typical addiction stories previous to that, or were you just a regular girl and having a regular life?
I would say my upbringing was pretty regular. My parents are still married. I've got a younger sister. We had a pretty typical, happy, good, family life growing up. Mm-hmm. But since coming into recovery and looking back on my childhood now, I can see, behaviors and things that I was doing that shows that, yeah, I was an addict before I picked up the drug.
Okay. So this is an important message, I think, because, it is often people's addiction, not hereditary, not because they were raised on the other side of the tracks, but because they got into an accident and, mm-hmm. and maybe had some naivety or some ignorance around the types of medication they're, mm-hmm. They're being prescribed. Did you get sick once and then get really scared? Did you, did the doctor that you were seeing sort of just give you whatever you asked for? Did he seem to have, or he or she seem to have education in addiction? Or were you being told that, you won't get addicted to this? What was that part of it?
Well, so I was actually offered, OxyContin by a family doctor, but I was too scared to take it at that time. And so I kind of went on my way for a little bit, not using any prescription pills. And then a friend that I knew had offered me a Percocet. So that was kind of the beginning. And it took a couple years till it got out of hand. And by that time I had spent a student loan. It took me quite a long time to actually get sick, because I had so much, not so much, but it wasn't an issue. I just went to the bank and mm-hmm. took money out for my student loan. And yeah, so it took a while, and I was into it pretty deep by the time that, yeah, I got sick and I knew that there was a problem, but I chose not to look at it for quite a while.
Interesting. So you were actually scared to take OxyContin, mm-hmm. a prescription yeah. from the doctor.
Yep.
From a, you know, a trusted...
Because I knew what was going to happen, and then...
What did you know what was going to happen at the time?
Well, I'd heard stories, like, of people getting addicted and being physically dependent and it being hard to come off, and, like, yeah, I just never thought my life was going to... I never... That wasn't, like, in my plans for life, you know, to
yeah.
become a drug addict, and so...
That's yeah. amazing, because it speaks a lot to, you know, the physical pain, a little bit of the difference of from physical pain to, like, you know, a psychological pain or an emotional pain, you know, how we can actually, like, no, I'll go through physical pain, you know, if the consequence is going to be possible addiction and things like that, but mm-hmm. it seems like once we, you know, we start getting... a little sidetracked in life, a little insecurity comes into play, and you know, then mm-hmm. it's like, yeah, like I need something now, hey?
Yeah.
So how old were you when you took that Percocet?
I got in the car accident when I was 19, so I was probably 19 or 20.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then what happened with college?
Well, yeah, so the accident was a couple days before to start my third year of university, so I withdrew from that. And I took a couple of years off, and then the addiction and the depression and not doing anything productive with my life, having no purpose, I really wanted to go back to school, so I tried to go back to school, knowing that I was, like, addicted to drugs, and I did complete my third year somehow, and then my fourth year was just completely out of hand, so I ended up getting a medical withdrawal from that, and... yeah, my addiction went on for a couple more years after that until I decided to get clean.
Okay, so now that, you know, we're all aware of the fentanyl mm-hmm. situation that's going on, it seems to be in everything. Did you know what you, like, because it's so important whether or not, you know, people that are trying something for the first time mm-hmm. right now, young girl, you know, like, such as yourself, in these similar situations, did you know, were you aware of what fentanyl was? Did you know it was in whatever you were taking? Or was this, you know, at the point where the heroin was not doing its job and you were just looking for a stronger medicine?
That's a good question. So, well, I started using heroin when the medical system changed the oxys to the kind where you weren't able to crush them down and snort them. So I started using these fake oxys, they call them, but they're actually made of fentanyl, and I didn't know that. And then, so I already had become addicted to it, and I didn't even know. And then I started using heroin, and no one really was talking about fentanyl at this time. Like, this is quite a number of years ago, and I guess we had been using it for, like, probably a year and just fully addicted to it, and it was like the only stuff that we wanted and we liked it, and it makes sense now, but I had no idea at the time that I'd become addicted to fentanyl.
Wow. So what led to treatment? I mean, family must have been concerned over this, you mm-hmm. know, last year. Was there multiple attempts of trying to stop? Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, so there was multiple attempts. The first time I went to treatment was in 2012, and that was by intervention. And I was not looking to get clean at that time, but I value my family, and they really wanted me to go, so I thought I would give it a try. It was unsuccessful. I only stayed in treatment for 2 weeks that time. And then I went to another facility in 2013, I believe, and I completed, and I stayed clean for a little bit there, but I relapsed. And this time around, so like I said, I had a baby, and my parents were involved. Like, I'd kind of been talking to them about treatment, but I don't know, I was just scared to go to treatment because I didn't think that I was actually going to be able to, like, I wanted to be a mom and I wanted to have a better life, but I didn't think I was going to be able to lose the desire to use drugs, so I was scared to come. But yeah, I guess I figured I would give it one last shot, and it's working so far, so.
Right on. Well, thankfully that's mm-hmm. You know, you got in there before, you know, some of these major consequences
mm-hmm.
That we hear so much about happen. a little bit about methadone. Was that part of your story?
Yes. Yeah, so, well, because I was using when I got pregnant, so my doctor suggested to me, like, you need to get on methadone and stop using everything else that you're using. So I did get on methadone, and it was kind of, well, interesting is for lack of a better word, but so I was on about 150 mils of methadone when I was 6 months pregnant, and that's quite a lot for, yeah, like, the body weight that I was, and, yeah, like, they just upped me in a really short amount of time, and, yeah, so my son was born addicted. He spent 2 months in the hospital having to come off of that taper because, I mean, that, yeah, like, that's a lot for a tiny little baby to be on, and, yeah, like, they just said, like, the solution will be methadone, but, like, there was no other discussion about anything. Like, I mean, obviously, I still was, like, completely living this lifestyle, and, like, yeah, like, there was no solution around it, so it's, like, they just said, like, here's methadone, this will be the solution, and your baby's going to be fine, but, I mean, really, like, it didn't really change anything except give me more drugs on top of what I was already using.
Right.
So,
yeah. It sounds like a crazy protocol.
It makes no sense at all.
You know, but this is the world we live in. Mm-hmm. And you know, if your story and the lack of education or the, you know what I mean? Like, I know it's not like we're ones to go out and do research, mm-hmm. you know, while our life is, you know, snowballing. But, you know, this could be the research for someone, right?
Yeah.
You know, So that's handling a lot of difficulties, like, you know, a lot of pressure, a lot of people telling you, you know, what to do and what's best and what's mm-hmm. best for your baby. And so where did it go from there? How did you get then into treatment for the last time?
Well, I did something to upset my mother. And so she basically said, like, you have a week to, you know, call Westminster House or I'm going to phone the police on you. So I said,
nice. Okay.
Yeah. So I stole from her. And so, yeah, she gave me that decision to make. And so I waited a week and I called Westminster House and I ended up going there and I stayed and I completed treatment. I went to the transition house. I took part in the aftercare program there. And yeah, I've managed to stay clean, so.
Is your son in your life?
Yeah, I got custody. I got full custody of him at 6 months clean, which is really awesome. So I've had him living with me full time for over a year now, and my ministry file is closed, and yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, 6 months clean. How old's your son?
He's 2. He turned 2 in September.
Oh.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so I'm personally curious about this else. So a lot of people say they're born with addiction. And it's like, well, you know, maybe the babies that were born while a mother was using, mm-hmm. you know, or while she carried the child, you know, were actually addicted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, born. Mm-hmm. Like, born addicted, sorry. Is there an overwhelming concern for you that he's going to turn out, you know what I mean? Or right now, is he just like an average, regular 2-year-old?
Yeah, he's really awesome. Yeah, there was some concerns for me, like, beforehand, but, like, I don't know. He is honestly one of the happiest, easygoing, funny. Like, he sleeps through the night. He eats. He's not picky. Like, he's just, he's a super great kid, and I'm really, really blessed that everything's worked out. So,
right on. Because mm-hmm. I mean, I would, you know, just hate to see, you know, a life of just like putting the little guy in mm-hmm. a jar. You know what I mean? You know, throwing away the key is for fear of, you know, he's already had a rough beginning, but he's right now, he's just a 2-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Facing what every other 2-year-old is facing.
And right? Of course, it's like, yeah, it's a thought in my mind. Like, it's like, so both of his parents are addicts. And he was in the womb on methadone. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, it's something that I wonder, but for now he's doing great. And I mean, yeah.
So you're 20 months clean right now. So, like, what's the future like? What it means, school, being a mother? Like, what do you see your life and what's ahead for you right now?
Well, I eventually want to finish the degree that I was pursuing previous to getting clean. I have 1 year left to finish that. But right now I am in school part-time. I'm taking a fundraising and marketing class because I work at Westminster House. I'm fully employed there, and I do the fundraising there. So I'm taking school part-time, working there full-time, and then just being a mom and doing recovery.
Right on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's such a hard, difficult story, an emotional story, you know, over the last few years. I'm sure, you know, yourself being the one going through it, but you know, so many people right now are currently in that. They're in that devastated space, you know. They don't see a way out. You know, options are going, you know, family's mad at them. You know, what's sort of the, you know, something you could say to somebody in a situation like yours?
Well, I just want to emphasize that there is hope for everyone, and like, this addiction can happen to anyone. Like, it doesn't discriminate. Like, I mean, like I said, like, my family upbringing was great. I was in school, I did sports, like, everything was great. But yeah, it can happen to anyone, and anyone can get clean. Yeah, it doesn't matter who you are, who you know, or what's going on. Like, there's hope for anyone. Yeah. So
And it was beneficial for you to go to an all woman treatment?
I had tried the other treatment centers I went to previously were co-ed, and I was hesitant to go to an all-women's facility because I felt like I connected better with men. But I also kind of knew deep down that if I wanted to really look at my issues and get clean and stay clean, that I was going to need to be in an all-women's facility because that's just what's best.
Right on.
Yeah.
Well, Jordan, a great success story. You know, anything you want ahead of you, obviously, and working in the place that you got clean in,
yeah,
and also from the same place, the new Westminster House. Christy's sitting in with us today as well. So you were there while Jordan came in. Did you get to see the whole process?
I answered the phone when Jordan called and said,
yes.
She was like, I want to come to treatment. I was like, okay, do you want to come tomorrow? And she's like, no, not tomorrow.
So like, when it's just a voice on the other end of the phone, like, it's just somebody somewhere, you know, making a phone call, and now to be sitting here right
now. It's really
now,
cool.
Must be pretty special.
And now, like, we work in the same office. We're working together on the Win a Car raffle, which is awesome. And she's doing fundraising for Westminster House, and it's really cool, and I'm really proud of her.
Right on. So what's going on at Westminster House? Tell us a little bit about that.
So we're raising money for the ongoing recovery aftercare program that Jordan was talking about earlier. It's basically a program for the women who complete primary care to come back to Westminster House and participate in events and get educated and do volunteer. And the program is 100% relied on donations. It's not publicly funded by the ministry or the health authority or anything like that. So we're actually raffling off a 2017 Toyota Corolla, which Jordan is heading. So it's pretty awesome.
Right on.
Yeah,
Toyota
awesome.
Corolla 2017. I can't even imagine what that looks like. I haven't what a Corolla looks like, but I'm sure it's a swanky little car.
Yeah.
So being there right from that initial first phone call, I mean, this is sort of the reward of working in a treatment, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's
great.
It's not all like this. It has, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of different for me because I don't work in primary care. So I answered the phone when she called, organized her intake, and now I get to work with her on the other side.
Oh, I see.
So I kind of miss the middle part, but that's okay. But it's still really awesome, and yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's always a part of the story, you know, whether you're there for everything along the way, you know, seeing somebody from the very beginning, you know, to where they are now. It's the proof. It's why we do this show. It's why we sit down and have conversations with people. So, you know, because that middle part is so ugly sometimes, and so disruptive. why don't you just film yourself there, Giuseppe, when you're doing... So Giuseppe's writing notes during our interview right now, left-handed and upside down. Yeah. Can you read that?
No, I got that. So basically, if you want to support our ongoing recovery program to help people like Jordan, you can buy tickets for the Win a Car raffle at our website, westminsterhouse.ca. Is that what you...
Oh, boy. Tickets. I'm sorry. That's funny. Oh.
Tickets are $25, and, yeah, all the proceeds go towards the ongoing recovery program at Westminster House.
Yeah.
Well, this is... I mean, this is a lot of why we do the show. Like, your story, Jordan, like, you know, being able to share, you know, some difficult stuff, like some real, honest, vulnerable stuff. And it's, I think, has been the problem for so, so long through the whole, like, for... whenever addiction was invented, you know, that part of the protocol with the invention of addiction was that you don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. You don't talk about the hard stuff. And then the other person that gets involved with addiction has no reference points to what to do, where to go, how they should feel, and the fact that there's hope on the other on the other side. So, I mean, thanks so much for coming in and sharing that story,
story. Thank you for having us.
Yeah. And Christy, thanks for coming in and being able to read Giuseppe's upside down left-handed message there, because this he tried one over here with me too, and it,
I got that one, too.
Yeah, I saw it.
Well, so if you wonder why I sort of paused during my interview to gather my thoughts, because I was trying to read unlegible words. Again, thanks for coming in and watching Facebook Live, and thank you to our guests and Dr. Stephanie Covington, who we interviewed first up on the show. And that's all the time we have. Keep on keeping on is the theme of today's show. And women do recover absolutely 100% from, you know, whatever the story is, was, and could be that you can recover. So let's end the show today with a little Rhythms of the Earth featuring Xavier Rudd. And this is Rhythms of the Earth. See you next week.
It all seems so
wrapped up, safe and warm.
She's heard these sounds from
their lives.
Rock-a-bye-bye, rock-a-bye-bye.
Wrapped up, safe and warm.
She cried
into their lives.
Rock-a-bye-bye, rock-a-bye-bye.
Rises up to meet her.
Where she lies.
Cause the ground no longer
rises up to meet her.
Where she lies.
Two hearts have become one.
And they beat amongst the
barrels. Two hearts have become one.
These are the
rhythms of the
earth. Different drums.
And they're calling
these
us back
the
home
of the earth.
From the moment of
and
our
they're calling
birth.
Us back home.
They're inside our hearts.
From the moment of our birth.
They're inside our hearts and our bones.
As time goes, she looks on. Mama's needing dough again. And as she does, she sings.
As time goes, she looks on. Mama's needing dough again.
And as
she
does, she
sings.
They tell her one day she'll
understand
by the train tracks she walks through.
They tell her one day.